Recording live from the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago, this is Booth One, celebrating the art of lively conversation and taking an in-depth look at the performing arts and popular culture. I am, as always, your host, Gary Zabinski, and we've been invited once again to the famous Steppenwolf to chat today with the creators of the world premiere play Passover by playwright Antoinette Nwandu.
Yes.
I got that right
you
on
did.
The first try, which is currently in rehearsal and starts previews on June 1st. We're privileged to have in the guest booth today Miss Nwandu and director Danya Taymor. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you both, and thank you for taking the time out from what I'm sure is an intensive rehearsal schedule to join me today. You know, it's rare on this program that we do an in-depth look at a play or a musical without actually having seen it first.
Right.
So we're going to talk a lot about process today, since you're deep in the middle of it, about to go into tech rehearsals, I'm sure. Antoinette, let me start with you. Tell us a little bit about the origins of Passover. And for our listeners, by the way, it's two separate words, Passover, and the impetus that you had to create this piece.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having us. The play for me started from three separate spheres, I like to say. The first was personal, the second was professional, and the third was political. Personally, I was in a bit of a wilderness space with my writing. I had gotten my MFA in playwriting from NYU several years before, but I was pretty despondent and floating and in that space that a lot of people find themselves in, where it's like, I'm not a hobbyist, I'm not an amateur, but I'm also not making work in the way that I want. And so there was a lot of confusion and a lot of sense of floating. And that was the personal and also perhaps the least interesting or least important aspect. And then professionally, at the time, I was a full-time professor at the Borough of Manhattan Community College, which is one of the CUNY schools in Manhattan. And I was teaching young men and women, two of whom caught my eye and sort of grabbed my attention because they developed over the course of the semester a really lovely friendship between the two of them. And
what was the course you were teaching? What were you?
Taught public speaking.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you're very good at it.
Thank you. Yes, it was a course that filled many students with dread.
I'm sure.
And so it was lovely to be able to draw students out and help them find their voices, really. And so I had two students in a class one semester who became very good friends with each other, and then one of them stopped showing up for class, which, just for context, was not actually that uncommon. But I did follow up with him, and it turns out that because of something really minor and really sort of foolish, he was in a catch-22 situation in the system, and so he was unable to finish the course, and that friendship sort of split up. Mm-hmm. And so that was something I was watching happen every day over a 13 to 16 week period of the semester. So I had the personal blahs in my career. I had the professional sort of seeing this relationship happen, seeing the way my students spoke to one another, seeing the relationship between them develop and then sort of be fractured very quickly and sort of absurdly for something that didn't seem to warrant that kind of action. And then obviously politically and nationally, this was all happening around the time of Trayvon Martin's death, which was unfortunately not the only incident like that that has happened, obviously, since then, but the one that sort of galvanized me. And so I was feeling very angry, but also very impotent. I was feeling like there was absurdity happening on all levels.
Mm-hmm.
I am someone who loves Beckett. I've always loved Beckett, especially Waiting for Godot. And I'm also somebody who was raised in the church and has a certain kind of biblical literacy. So,
and this play is, well, it's described in the Steppenwolf literature as a riff on Waiting for Godot in a sort of hilarious and political and touching way. So you started with an absurdist play, and you decided to infuse it with your own personal and professional needs or things that were affecting you at the time, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There's actually, I mean, for me, there's sort of two texts in addition to all of my personal inflection that I obviously bring into the play, it's really Waiting for Godot and the biblical Exodus story, which is where the title sort of comes from.
It's a play on words.
It's a play on that title.
On a number of levels.
Absolutely. On one hand, you have this biblical Exodus story, which is just so epic and sort of has this undercurrent of hope, and there's a promised land, and then on the other hand, you have Waiting for Godot, where you're like, you know, you might wait for a very long time and nothing shows up.
Right. And before our listeners get the feeling that they're going to be watching a biblical epic with a cast of thousands, Danya, as director, what, in your own words, describe to us what this play is about.
I would say in the most basic terms, this play is about the never-ending cycle of violence against young black men. In its most simple way, it draws on all these different forms, and Antoinette has a great sense of rhythm and of history and of other forms. But the reason why it's so important to be doing this play now, and a lot of the rewrite process during our rehearsal, has been towards making it speak to this exact moment, speak to June 2017 at Steppenwolf in Chicago. To me, that's what the play is about.
It's a cast of just three.
Mm-hmm.
Ensemble, Steppenwolf ensemble member John Michael Hill is in it.
Yes.
I believe he plays a character called
Moses.
Isn't that, that's absolutely perfect. Also, Ryan Hallahan and Julian Parker are in it. For both of you, talk to me about this idea of the promised land, which is certainly one of the main themes of the book of Exodus.
Yeah.
And you use that quite a lot in this piece as a point of either departure or a point of journey towards.
I think it's a point of hope, and it's definitely a hoped-for destination for our young dynamic duo.
I also think, though, in the play, the words promised land have many different meanings, like the words Passover. And at times, the promised land represents a false promise. I often think of the American dream as something that's fed to everybody in this country from cradle to the grave. And what does it mean? And is it actually a positive thing? What happens when you are promised something that you are kept from achieving?
So how are rehearsals going?
Rehearsals are going great.
Rehearsals are going really, really well.
Are you doing much rewriting?
Yes. Antoinette just finished the most Herculean task I've ever... I mean, I direct a lot of new plays. And every single day we had immense goals for rewriting because this play didn't have a workshop. So we've been sort of workshopping the play while we're also rehearsing the play. So every day we get new pages. And every day we would set a goal for the next day's pages. And every single day Antoinette delivered. It was incredible. This doesn't always happen. So we thought of a time when we needed to pause the rewrites. We'll probably pick them up again during previews. But we just finished basically 2 weeks of furious rewrites.
We added about 30 pages to the text.
My goodness.
And
that's a good half hour of the show, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. The show has pacing, but yeah, it's about a good half hour. And no page was untouched, except for the title page.
Yes.
I didn't change the title of the play.
But the breakdown, even the description of the characters changed in this rewrite.
Added a character.
You added a character?
Yeah.
Did you add an actor as well?
No,
or is it
the mighty Ryan Hallahan is doing double duty in a way that is just exciting and spectacular.
That's a radical rewrite.
I mean, yeah, I don't mess around.
Well, it is radical, but to me it also, you know, Antoinette and I got together before we started rehearsal, and she had these two drafts that she referred to as a biblical draft and a Beckettian draft.
True.
And her goal was to sort of knit them together. And I think that's what she's done. So it isn't like a rewrite that changes the play's essence. The play has
Absolutely.
Always been itself. And what I think is now it's never oblique. Or when it's oblique, it's on purpose. There's a kind of clarity to it that was in its bones already, but sort of hard to decipher.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely harder for an audience to decipher.
Mm-hmm.
You could study it and understand it. And especially when you added actors, it became even easier to understand. But there were still these moments that weren't totally clear. So that's been a lot of the rewrite as well. It's just clarifying what's already been in the text.
Danya, what sort of directing techniques have you been using in rehearsal, along with Antoinette, to help you develop this mm-hmm. play. As you said, it didn't have a workshop, so this is the rehearsal process is essentially workshopping it in the same time that you're making rewrites and adding characters. What kind of techniques were you using? Did you do a little improv? Were you using theater games? And was the cast, I know this is a long question, were they very instrumental in helping you find the new voices, especially these 30 pages that you rewrote?
Certainly. So we spent a lot of time doing what I'll call the cast's favorite part of the day, which is a really intense physical warm-up. We needed to create intimacy really quickly, and this is something that I do. So we didn't do, I wouldn't call them theater games. It's more like boot camp, where mm-hmm. we do like
they
very,
sweat a
we
lot.
Sweat. Like we do burpees, and we run, and they have to get hot enough to do these really great partner stretches that are Grotowski stretches mm-hmm. that require lots of communication, lots of touching, stretching, farther than you can go yourself. So we did a lot of that in the first week to sort of speed up the process of intimacy. And then we pretty quickly staged the play. I would say, like, let's do a run through. So I think we had the whole play staged within a week and a half because mm-hmm. Antoinette would be writing for the first few hours. And so we would just throw it up because it didn't seem to make sense to spend so much time around a table talking about things that might change. And I also, because our process is short, wanted the actors to feel very comfortable that they would be prepared to go into tech and to do these previews, that their physical life would be out of their heads so that they weren't in their brains, they could be in their bodies. And so rewrites felt less like a total mind shift and more like something, I don't know, something easier to integrate. And this week has been interesting because it's our first week with the script pages unchanged. And we are kind of going back to the table. And now that things are set, we're able to really dig deep into the questions in a way that feels more meaningful. But these actors, I want to say they're keeping us honest. Anything that feels false or feels confusing, that's what we're trying to suss out. And so they've really attuned themselves to those kinds of questions. We're trying to assume that the audience is incredibly intelligent. So, like, nothing, we can't sneak anything by them.
Well, I guess I won't be coming. I need cliff notes.
Well, that's
and
what
director's
this part
notes.
Does.
Yeah.
Well, no, this makes it easier. I think this is just like you can't sneak anything by. This is actually a more clear version, an easier
Absolutely.
Version to understand.
Much
There's just no
clear.
Red herrings in this version necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Antoinette, do you consider this play a comedy, a drama, or somewhere in between? How would you categorize it if you were trying to sell this to somebody?
Yes.
The answer is yes. I write with a lot of jagged tonal shifts. So we can have an absurdist beat that drops into terror, that drops into despair, and then we'll have a silence, and then they'll start with a joke again. So that for me, when Danya was talking about combining those two drafts, it's true. I had thesis, I had antithesis, and now I need synthesis. Hopefully, one of the experiences of this play is going on the roller coaster journey with these two young men. There are absolutely, and I might be a little biased, but there are absolutely laugh out loud, hilarious moments. Jokes that I'm really proud of that the actors are just infusing with such craft and such life. And then there are moments of deep sadness and moments of very in-your-face despair.
And there's also a good dose of dread. I think about these some
dread,
In Pinter plays, like in The Room. That's something underneath the surface that permeates, but it's not during the whole entire play. I think what Antoinette said is really true, which is like the truth of the play can shift on a dime, and whatever was true in the moment is true, and then 2 seconds later, a whole different thing becomes true, and the tone just goes, phoom, and that makes it very, very exciting.
And as I understand it, the basic structure of the play is two young men on a street corner
mm-hmm.
chatting,
mm-hmm.
whatever they're chatting about,
mm-hmm.
and someone enters the picture.
Someone enters their space.
Very much like Waiting for Godot, that
Absolutely.
Structure, of course.
And then the new character that we added, you know, in Godot, that Lucky and Pozzo come in and then leave, and then the boy comes
yes.
and then leaves. So we needed Ryan to
come back
as
yes.
the boy.
Did you start out to write a play around the kind of structure that Godot has, or is it something that just kind of happened as you were putting your, as you say, personal, professional, and political viewpoints together?
Yeah, when I think back to that very first draft, I don't think I was as structurally married to Godot. But I do think that somewhere on the journey, I thought, oh, these other texts can work for me not only in content, but in organizing patterns. Mm-hmm. So I do remember, I don't recall when that happened because it feels so of the piece now, but I do remember sort of having that aha moment where I was like, oh, someone's already figured this out. Yes. I can just use what Beckett's, he's pretty good. Yeah. I could just use his structure.
It's the greatest form of flattery.
Absolutely.
Stealing stuff.
Absolutely. I was like,
well,
yeah,
and she's had to be really creative because we only have three actors. And Godot has five.
He does.
You know?
He has
so
five.
It is, yeah. It's different even if it is a riff. I think that is actually a great word to describe what it is. It's
absolutely.
Not an adaptation.
It's, oh God, no.
It's or an imitation.
It's a reaction to or like an embracing of.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, and again, keep me honest here, you don't have to know either the Bible or Beckett to follow the story or be pulled in. So that's definitely the one thing. I don't want to have people have cliff notes in any way, shape, or form.
Neither of you has worked at Steppenwolf previously. Is that true?
That is true.
It's your first time.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how Steppenwolf has created an environment for you that is conducive to the creative process and supporting new works. I guess I'm asking, how have you enjoyed your experience so far?
It's been amazing. It's been really, really, truly amazing.
<It's been> amazing.
This process has been fast and furious, and we came here on the first day and we had a production meeting. We went to the shop to look at this incredible set that they're building for us, and we already had new ideas. And we were like, what if we did this? And what if we changed this? And can we move this around? And how much wiggle room is there? And they've done everything in their power to make us have that. It's the closest professional experience I've ever had to my ideal, which is that design can be live in the room as the script is also live, as the actors are creating something new. The design has been able to shift to accommodate the creative process. And because Steppenwolf is such an incredible institution, they're doing it in a huge way for us. So not only do they trust us and trust the actors that they can handle 2 weeks of daily rewrites, but they trust us enough to keep this design fluid and provide us new things, kind of difficult new things that we need and always go with us. And they also trust us and leave us alone in the room to do it.
They're a very nimble organization, aren't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely.
They're willing to move. How did you first approach Steppenwolf with this play, Antoinette, or vice versa?
It was a bit of a Cinderella story, so I kind of don't like to tell it because I don't want young writers to think that this happens
This is normal.
It's not.
Disclaimer, young writers, do not do it this way.
Don't plan on this.
Right. I signed with Di Glaser and Ross Wiener at ICM the day before Halloween of 2015, randomly. And by the following Valentine's Day, I was on a plane to Steppenwolf because they sent the play to Steppenwolf. And then I got that phone call that was like, oh, Steppenwolf is reading it. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. They're reading it. No, they're calling you. I think they're going to fly me. They're going to pay for a plane ticket to fly me out to do a reading of the play. And that was the first time I met John Michael Hill and Julian Parker. Actually, wonderfully, the both of them did that reading. And then I got home from that reading and I was on cloud nine. They know my work now. You know what I mean? So now when I write my next play, I'll be able to send it to them. And like, we have the beginning of a relationship. And I was already on cloud nine. And then I kid you not, 5 days later, Aaron Carter, who I love dearly,
yes,
called me. And Aaron and I had known each other for several years before that. And he was like, Antoinette, we're going to do your play. And I was like, what play? What are you? And he was like, no, Passover. And I literally could not believe that was true. And it was true, and it is true, and
it's happening.
And it's not a dream. It is, in fact, not a dream.
And it doesn't happen that way
very often. No.
You're usually sending your scripts
forever and ever.
You're lucky to get a reading someplace.
Absolutely. Even my agent was like, this will never happen again. She was like, I sent it to a place that is the place, and then they said yes.
You've worked together before on a play called Flat Sam, is that correct?
Yes.
I don't know much about that play, really, or where you did it. I just know that you worked together on it. Also, an original script.
Yes.
Was it a world premiere that you worked on?
It was a workshop at this incredible organization called Playpen in Philadelphia. Mm. And they provide a long-term development process for a play where you can experiment with putting some things on its feet, but the presentations can be very simple. So the work we were able to do in the room was very physical, and we didn't have the pressure of production or the pressure of review, because that play, even more so in some ways than Passover, it's theatrically challenging.
There's
even sharper hairpin turns, yeah. And there's production things that for me are so exciting to think about, like a flat cardboard person coming to life instantly. It's about, do you want to say?
It's the story of an army wife who is at home pining for her husband, and so she falls in love with his full-sized cardboard cutout. And in sort of making that wish that sort of ill-fated wish, he comes to life.
I'm guessing his name is Sam.
His name is Sam,
hence
yes.
Flat Sam.
Yes, yes, yes. You are a good audience member,
see?
Yes.
I pay attention. How did you get paired up for this project? Was it random?
No. We actually met to discuss a play called Passover, right. Which was having a workshop production at the Cherry Lane in New York. And that was the first time Antoinette and I met.
Yeah.
And Antoinette had not seen my work at that point, and I didn't get the job.
True.
But I knew that Antoinette and I had this incredible connection. And so it didn't really bother me. I loved the play, and I loved her. And it's kind of like, you know, if it's not that one, life is so long. There are so many things to work on. So when Flat Sam came up, we have the same agent, too. I got a call that said, Antoinette would like to work with you on this one. And so we got to have this incredible experience in Philadelphia, and it was so nice. Like, we joked that we're traveling the United States together.
This is
because
true.
After this, we're going to Sundance to work on another play of hers.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
So we're just seeing the sights, but...
No, we're seeing one state at a time.
That's fantastic.
But it was incredible.
And you found that you found a certain symbiotic relationship between you.
Definitely.
You kind of speak the same language. It's almost as if you can finish each other's sentences at times. Is that
girl.
Complimentary,
girl?
It is. And I also think that we have parts of ourselves that are very different and complementary in that way.
Absolutely.
In a way that Antoinette, I mean, I definitely think I'm a very rhythm-oriented director. Our language is very important to me, but I always defer to Antoinette on the language of her own plays. And then visually, I think that I have an easier time seeing her plays than she does.
Absolutely.
At times.
Absolutely. I never see my plays. I always hear them. But then also, Danya comes in with this, like, world-class knowledge of all theater. Like, the number of times she'll come in and be like, oh, read this. See this. This is making me think of this. And I'm like, okay, make me a reading list, and then we'll talk about it. And it's amazing. It's amazing to have somebody who can bring in the influences that are there and that are sort of underpinning the work, not only for me, but for the actors as well, because the work then just sort of gets to breathe in a healthier way and in a bigger way. So,
well,
yeah, I think
as they say, if you're going to have a career in the theater, especially as a director, know everything. Never stop learning.
Absolutely.
Always.
Absolutely.
For our listeners who I'm sure from the beginning of the show have been curious, I have to mention this. Your last name is Taymor.
It is.
And your aunt is Julie Taymor.
Correct.
Is that right?
It is right.
So you do have a little bit of a theatrical background going.
I certainly do. And an interesting thing with my relationship to Julie is I grew up on the opposite side of the country. So I grew up in California and she lives in New York. So growing up, I knew of her. We weren't as close as we are now, obviously, now that I work in New York and do theater. I would see her a few times a year and see her work as a kid. But growing up, I didn't actually think I was going to do this, which is strange to think because I had this model in my family of like how it could work out. But it's been amazing. I've assisted her a few times, and she's got an incredible eagle eye for detail. And that has definitely, I've absorbed that. And that's been incredible. And she also has a great ear for language. So it's been incredible to have her in my life. But in my formative years, I would say my parents, I have to give it up to them because they brought me to the theater. They kind of dragged me to the theater. I didn't always like it. And to classical music and to museums, you know, they're both physicians, but my mom is like a secret painter and my dad is a secret musician. And so so I had all these incredible influences and they took me to the theater as a kid. And I think that was super important to this like open world thing that, yeah. that Antoinette is talking about.
This brings me to a question that I've asked a number of our guests before on this program. And you're both young women. You've got years and years of great stuff ahead of you. And you mentioned your formative years. I imagine you're still
like
in your
formative
years.
I meant like, you know, in terms of Freud.
So, so you were teaching for a time,
yes.
as well. If you could do any other profession other than in the theater, if you had to choose and you could be qualified for it, what would you like to do, Antoinette?
That's actually interesting that you asked that because, I mean, I was a professor. I was a professor for several years. So I don't think I can say professor again because I'm a little burnt out on that. But before I started writing Passover, when I was in my sort of personal funk, I did actually give up. I went on interviews for advertising because I thought, okay, I have all of this storytelling knowledge that doesn't transfer to very many places. I've kind of boxed myself in. And so I went on 2 or 3 interviews thinking that maybe I could tell the story of a product or something like that. I was like, I don't know, how do you use this information? I don't know if I would like it or I don't know if I would be good at it, but I did sort of pull that trigger, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, so maybe advertising.
How about you, Danya? You've had time to think.
This yeah. Right, a, yeah.
I've gone through a couple. There's a couple options in my mind. I mean, at school, for undergrad, I studied public health, and I never took enough courses to become a doctor, and I don't know if that's really what I would want to be, but something in the public health sector would be very interesting. I also think that my parents joke that I should be a judge.
you should be a judge.
That was my calling. That's what I should have been. That's
can one so actually funny. Aspire to that? I guess you have to be a lawyer first.
Yeah,
and then you
and
I wouldn't
want to
get
that.
Appointed or run for office
yeah.
or something.
I think I could be happy doing that kind of work, doing like psychological work abroad, traveling. You know, part of what I do with theater is go work in places that don't have great access to theater because it's an incredible social tool. It's such an equalizer. I've done a lot of work in South America. And
I see by some of the notes that I was able to acquire that you've worked in Ecuador and Slovakia.
And Slovakia. And that kind of work, you know, I know that that's still directing theater, but it's in such a different capacity. Mm-hmm. And that... I think part of me would be happy to do that all the time. It's definitely what feeds my work. And actually, a play like Passover, for me, it's an incredible, you know, synthesis of all of my passions, of public health, of public service, of theater, at an institution like Steppenwolf. It mm-hmm. kind of ticks all these boxes. But I didn't really answer your question.
I think you sort of have.
I think if I was something totally different, I would probably be a psychiatrist.
Well, that just came out of nowhere.
That's the real answer, I think.
Right.
If I was really going to leave it now and go pursue something else seriously
right.
that had nothing to do with theater, not that psychiatry doesn't. I mean, that's probably what I would do.
Yeah. Interesting. You're doing a new play as well in February, I believe, something
yes.
called Breach.
Yes.
It's going to be at the Victory Gardens
yes.
Theater, also here in Chicago.
Absolutely.
What can you tell us about that play?
That's a slightly older play than Passover. So I wrote that one before I wrote this one. And then, yeah, it was just, I mean, again, the hits just sort of kept coming. After Passover was decided, then I got this wonderful invitation from Che Yu and Isaac Gomez inviting me to, Victory Gardens has a summer festival for new plays called Ignition. And at that point, I was just like, oh my gosh, Breach, like somebody read, after like the Breach was my play that got all of the no's when I first wrote it. And so then, you know, you put it in a drawer and then you write the next thing and you're like, okay, whatever. So I was like, what? They read it and they liked it? Like they kind of reminded me that it existed. And so we did last August, we did the Ignition Festival, and it was great, and it got a great response. And then I was in LA a couple of weeks later, and Che called me up, and he was like, I have some notes for you. And I was like, oh, that's so generous of you. Like, you're going to give me notes on my play? Thank you so much. And then once again, he was just like, and we're going to produce it. What?
Wow.
You have to be kidding me.
You're the luckiest person in the world.
I mean, yes. Yes,
she also works her butt off.
True.
And she's a
true.
Brilliant,
well,
brilliant woman.
And you know, you make your own luck.
Absolutely.
A lot of times.
I'll take it.
As they say in the sports world, the more I practice, the luckier I get.
That's true.
Danya, you're also noted as a translator.
True.
Do you translate from Spanish or French?
I translate from Spanish to English, and I translate with an incredible couple, Ana Graham and Antonio Vega. They're not just actors. They're actors. She's a costume designer and a director. He's a writer and makes puppets. They're kind of this incredible couple that I met. They live part-time in Mexico City and part-time in New York, and they were the ones who sort of encouraged me to do it. And so I've translated all the plays you see, I've translated with them, which is incredible. And I also think has made me a much better director and fed into this understanding of language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you consider when you're translating something you give up rhythm for to gain content or context for. And so what are you willing to sacrifice for somebody else? And that kind of, you're doing that when you're directing too, in a way, even if you aren't changing words.
Have you directed a piece that you've also translated?
I have. The first play I did in New York, it's called I Hate Fucking Mexicans, mm-hmm. by Luis Enrique Gutierrez Ortiz Monasterio. Incredible Mexican playwright this is the first time his work had been done in English in the U.S. So I translated that play and directed it at the Flea Theater in New York City.
Awesome. If either of you could apprentice with someone, really seriously apprentice, who might that be and why?
You answer first this time.
With this director named, and theater maker, designer named Romeo Castellucci. He's Italian and he works in Italy with his wife and this huge company that they have. And they make work from the ground up. He does riffs on classic texts. I saw a version of Julius Caesar he did last year that was 45 minutes called Spare Parts. Brutus wasn't even in it at all. And it featured some actors who were disabled. One actor had a tracheotomy, so he didn't have vocal cords, but he was playing Mark Antony, this incredible speaker. And so he takes work, and he also is very inclusive and brings in performers who might not normally be considered and showcases their talent. I saw an incredible piece he did in New Jersey called Go Down Moses that was sort of about all human history. And so he and other Europeans, but his work more than any of the work I've seen is so vast. You know, America is the land of the playwright, not of the director. So that kind of career is so elusive here. There's a few places that nurture it. I definitely think that Anna Shapiro is somebody who nurtures directors.
Mm.
But that kind of large-scale work from the ground up, I think Jim Nicola at New York Theatre Workshop is somebody who tries to cultivate it. But because there's no government interest in it, it's harder here. But I would love to go spend 6 months with Romeo Castellucci, if you're listening.
Oh, I think he's a subscriber. I'm looking at our producer. Yeah, yes, if he's not, he will be. All right, nice. Antoinette, you've had time to think this time. Do you have someone that you would love to apprentice with?
I think it would probably be Carol Churchill.
Oh, great answer.
Because of the way she's made theater and just how interested I am in a devised process, in a process that sort of begins with real world research. I like the beautiful idea of going to a place and investigating that place and researching the themes, political or otherwise, that come out of that place, and then devising the work and putting the work on for those people. I think it's something akin to maybe what regional theater started out as, thinking of a play that was made for a specific group of people in a specific place. Mm. Not to say that, and I think that we are achieving a lot of that, like Danya said, I do think that Passover has been rewritten for this moment and in time.
But we're following the European model.
We are following the European model, but there's just something so beautiful about that devising way of getting everybody involved. All hands on deck.
I've done a Carol Churchill play. I was stage manager for many, many years, and I did a Carol Churchill play with Michael Greif. Greif directed. That's kind of an apprenticeship that I had.
Absolutely.
I've worked with some wonderful, wonderful directors and playwrights. Those are terrific answers. We're going to hear probably some ambient noise very soon because we're recording this just outside of the upstairs lobby of the main theater at Steppenwolf and the production of Linda Vista, Tracy Letts's new play. They have a 7:30 performance tonight.
Yes.
So we're going to hear the crowd in just a minute. Is there anything about Passover that you would like to let us know that we haven't discussed?
It's required viewing as a citizen of America in 2017.
You heard it here first. Ladies and gentlemen, required viewing. Get your tickets.
Well, it's in rehearsal. And Lastly, I just want to hear, what did you do in rehearsal today? How did the rehearsal process go today?
Today.
Yeah, take us through from this morning until this evening.
Today, somebody came in and filmed B-roll, so we did the first part of the play, and now this is our first week with Pages Locked, so we worked on Ryan's scenes. Ryan is the stranger, the intruder, the disruptor, and I feel like he's kind of gotten the short end of the stick because I've been creating this like really nice, intimate partnership with Julian and John. So we spent the first 4 hours working with Ryan to give him the same kind of detail attention that his character needs. Because in a lot of ways, the reason why we couldn't is because his character was the one who's developed the most. Mm-hmm. So that was a really satisfying. We did a lot of that on our feet. We returned to the table in ways that we haven't. And then we ended the day trying to get this. There's a section of the play in the second act. It's straight through an intermission, but we still refer to act one and two. But there's a portion that is incredibly Beckettian, and we were trying to get our vibe right. So we spent the last 2 hours working on this kind of like physical comedy, clowning, rhythm, relational experience for those two.
Have you had many visitors to the rehearsal room to see run-throughs and things, and have they found the laughter in all the right places?
We've had some. Some people have laughed. We have our first crew coming in on Thursday, which will be amazing. Now is the time that people, I'm going to start inviting lots and lots of people in, because this play is made for the audience. We're really thinking about them all the time, and I think these first few previews are going to be amazing for us, and I think we're going to have that first taste on Thursday when the Steppenwolf staff comes in and our designers come in to see the first run-through. We've run it for ourselves and for stage management, and they still laugh, even though it's been a couple of times.
Yeah, they do. We had some understudies in today who had no idea about any of the changes, and they laughed, which was very satisfying. Yes. I was like, oh, good. This is funny.
Yeah.
Well, Passover is a premiering here at the Steppenwolf Theater. You start previews on June 1st, and it runs through July 9th. So that's a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
People have a great opportunity to see it. It's in the upstairs theater here at Steppenwolf. And before and after the show, have you guys hung out at the front bar much? The new front bar?
This is an incredible thing. Anna Shapiro is a genius. Yeah. I mean, I think that creating a space, an all-day space that exists for the theater but also independent of the theater, is incredible. And it's so gorgeous to be in. And
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, we love it. We love that.
So come just for, get a drink in front.
You can grab a drink or some light fare before or after the show.
You'll need it after. You'll definitely need it after.
Get a drink after.
You can go to front-bar.com to find out more information about that. And certainly you can go to the steppenwolf.org website to find out more information about Passover. I don't know what else there is to say. We've covered Passover pretty well.
We have.
I appreciate the time, both of you, Antoinette, Danya. Best of luck with this project. You are so fortunate to be doing it here in such a supportive, safe, and, well, popular environment.
Absolutely.
You know, people love coming to the theater at Steppenwolf.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They don't feel like they have to go because it's the thing to do. They come because they want to be here, and you're going to have a wonderful, wonderful run. I can't wait to see it.
I hope to come to one
of the previews or shortly after opening.
Great.
Amazing.
Thank you both again.
Thank you.
For Booth One, this is Gary Zabinski saying, keep listening, and so long until next time.